Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir. The next narration reads according to the Holy Prophet that there is no animal, be it birds or any kind of animal, that if you yuqtal bighayr al-haq, if you kill it without any right, then satukhasimuhu yawm al-qiyamah. This narration is very powerful. On the day of judgment, that killed animal will come to you, I mean will come to the court of God and will complain against you.
Yes.
And it will ask for its rights against you. This also shows how, I mean, great is the right of the animal, the right of life for animals. According to another narration, the Holy Prophet says that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has cursed any person who kills the creatures, I mean the animals, I mean through shooting arrows without any reason. Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam, our sixth imam, is quoted as saying, this narration is also very interesting. He says that the most reprehensible sins are three. One of them is killing the animals, of course, without any reason. And the second is, refraining from paying the dowry of women and refraining from paying the wage of the one who works for you. So Imam Sadiq alayhi salam called killing the animals without any justified reason as one of the most reprehensible sins. So all these narrations refer to the fact that we are not allowed to kill any kind of animal when
without
it comes
reason.
To halal animals. It should be based on a wisdom, like, I mean, we slaughter just to provide the food. But we are not allowed just to kill a sheep just for fun. Just to, I mean, show that we have the ability to, I mean, shoot an arrow, for example.
Yes.
Or through a gun.
And even we have it with Imam Reza when he protects that gazelle.
Yeah.
So that means they have been very kind with the animals.
Exactly. That's a very
And
good
animal
example.
Right has a history in Islam as well. So now I have a question from you. Don't you think that killing animals, especially camels, the way that camels are being slaughtered for sacrifice is a bit of horrendous? What do you think about that? Isn't it considered to be a sort of torturing?
Inshallah, I will talk about some of the Islamic etiquette for slaughtering the animals. But quickly, let me refer to some of them. It's been proved that even, I mean, according to some researchers, we know that Islam asks the Muslim to slaughter the animals through an iron killing tool, like a very sharp knife. There are some recommendations, for example, inshallah I will share some of them later, but for example, the knife needs to be very sharp. And one
in
of the
order
reasons,
not to bother the animal.
Not to bother the animal, yeah. And the other point is that Islam says that you need to cut those four main arteries, and it's been proved that it happens within few seconds. As yes. soon as, I mean, those four main arteries are cut, after some seconds, the animal will not, feel the pain
anything,
anymore.
Yes.
Yeah. So this is one point. Because the fact is that when those four arteries are cut off, a great portion of the blood will gush forth and gush out of the body of the animals. So the animal will lose the blood pressure, and that is why it will not feel any kind of pain anymore. It's been proved in the science that, when the animal is slaughtered in this way, it is one of the fastest possible way for slaughtering the animal. This is one point. When it comes to, some people may argue that, so we may use, for example, electricity and so on and so forth. Again, it's been proved in the science that if you are going to, somehow kill the animals without that blood gushing forth and going out of the body of the animals, it will remain some, negative effect inside the body of the animals.
Yes.
So Islam says that you need to slaughter through this way. Islam has, of course, many recommendations. Inshallah, I will share. So might seem that it's a kind of torturing, but the pain is within maybe a very few, seconds, maybe less than 10 seconds. But then there is no pain, and then it will not have all those negative effects of, remaining blood inside the body of the animals.
Yeah.
So when we put together all these points, and science also helps us in this regard, we come to this conclusion that people, it might seem that it's very, a kind of heinous action done by the people, and maybe it is one of the faults of the people that they just slaughter animals in front of the eyes of the children. No, we are not allowed, we are not recommended to do that. When it comes to the time of the slaughter, we have, great recommendations.
Yes.
Inshallah, I will share some of them. When it comes to the knife, we have some recommendations.
Also recommended.
And for example, let me just share one point in this regard, that Islam says that it's very discouraged or makruh to kill an animal in front of other animals. Because of the fact that the other animals, they have feeling, they just see the other animal is slaughtered, and they also feel the pain.
Yes, they feel the pain.
So it's highly discouraged to do that, to slaughter an animal in front of other, for example, sheep, especially if it's a matter of, child and parents. So it's, highly discouraged in the religion of Islam. You are not allowed... it's discouraged to slaughter the animals at night. And this is because of the fact that some scholars argue that because Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says that the night is for the rest.
Yes.
Ja'ala al-layla sakana. The night is for the rest, not only for the human beings, but also for any other creature.
All the creatures, yes.
So it's very, again, discouraged to slaughter the animals at night. Let them, rest. You may do that, during the day.
Yeah.
So these are some etiquette that, inshallah, later I'll be sharing.
Yes,
share
thank you very much.
Inshallah.
So we learned that, after all, everything that happens in our religion, in Islam, has a scientific and logical background.
Sure.
So thank you. We learned that the animal right in Islam has got a long history, and whatever that happens to those animals during the slaughter is not just for fun. It has got a reason, and there's a logic behind it. And that's it. Thank you. We'll catch up in another session, and we'll discuss another question. This was Q&A on Islamic Belief, and this is IRB English Radio. We had a great time discussing with you. Thank you for listening.
إن في الجنة نهر اللبن إن في الجنة نهر اللبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن إن في الجنة نهر اللبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن كل من كان محبا لهم كل من كان محبا لهم يدخل الجنة من غير حزن يدخل الجنة من غير حزن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن
يوسف جلالي بتهران
روباشافيت غازا
جروم هيوز بروسلز
Said Poreza, London.
Russia, Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
It was the year UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson pledged to build back better. Some critics argued this was not just about restoring the UK's fiscal position after the ravages of COVID on the economy, but on reviving the country's international reputation that had taken a global hit after a few glaring missteps. If Johnson was hoping for a glorious scorecard to see out his political year, he was going to be left disappointed. Not only had he failed to make vital political inroads on the international stage, some pointed to the UK having gone backwards in some respects.
Britain no longer has this huge empire that it once had. It doesn't have a presence in any serious sense east of Suez. It was badly defeated in Afghanistan over the summer. That's 20 years of war, which has shown that we've come completely full circle as a result of that war. And therefore, Britain is being kind of cut down to size, I think, in terms of, you know, when people look at it. Its actual role in the world is much less.
For those expecting something different when it came to the sometimes subservient relationship that exists between Washington and London, well, 2021 was yet another year of disappointment, with the US setting the political agenda and Britain following that well-trodden path. The White House meeting between the US President Joe Biden and Britain's bumbling PM underscored the power imbalance between the two nations. After the trade deals dangled by the Trump administration failed to materialize, Johnson returned from Washington with nothing like the $300 billion in agreements, not that you'd sense the crushing disappointment at the time.
Then, of course, there's the progress that we're making in the defense technology partnership that you've led and with our Australian friends. That I think has great potential to benefit the whole of the world and the security of the whole of the world. So, Joe, thank you for having us. And I think, you know, we're boosting our shared agenda. We want to build back the world together with you. And I think we want to renew and strengthen our transatlantic bond. And it feels to me like it's going very, very well.
The shambolic withdrawal and embarrassing military climb down experienced by Britain's military after the US announced it was leaving Afghanistan exposed the UK's strategic weaknesses and had the minister in charge at the time attempting to explain the chaos away.
Of course, didn't put.
So that's a lie.
We did not put the welfare of animals above individuals.
I'm not
accusing anyone of lying, I'm just correcting the facts. What is certainly true is that we had a lot of people rushing to get out of Afghanistan for all sorts of reasons. And I think it's right that we had a process in place.
Not only was the UK caught on the back foot having to follow the US on the Afghanistan issue, its foreign policy position continues to ape Washington's agenda on China, Russia, Iran, Yemen, and Palestine, to name but a few. Perhaps the only area of foreign policy divergence is Brexit, where Washington has reiterated its pro-Brussels sentiments. Britain's most complicated and increasingly acrimonious foreign policy situation is the one that London and Brussels now find themselves in. Having exited the European Union, Britain now finds itself at odds with its former ally. A situation that has not been this bad in decades. Lord Frost passing the job of securing Britain's post-Brexit policies onto Foreign Secretary Liz Truss, it will be an uphill task for 2022.
The trade deals that Britain has made since Brexit have amounted to very little, including there hasn't been one with the United States. And therefore, Britain is sort of desperately trying to cling on to this military role while at the same time the wider economic issues are not necessarily going in their favour.
Britain's continued political pivot towards the US remains a risky strategy that has yet to bear genuine fruits for the UK in its own aims. With the country's Prime Minister still in bombastic, flag-waving mood, perhaps Boris Johnson feels tethering the UK's fortunes so closely to that of the US is still the way to go, despite new global realities indicating otherwise. Amina Taylor, London.
A meeting was held here in Western Kabul to bring the Islamic Emirate and the people closer together. The meeting was organized by a Shia association to pave the way for national solidarity in Afghanistan. During the meeting, the religious leaders and the Taliban officials stressed the need for mutual trust between people and the government.
One of the main responsibilities of the ruling group is nation building. Afghan nation is mainly composed of our Shia and Sunni brothers. We are part of United Ummah of Islam. In order to have a united Afghanistan, we should trust each other and rely on mutual values. The new government needs to represent all sections and ethnicities of Afghanistan.
Conspiracy is one of US and the Soviet Union's main heritages in our country. They destroyed the soil with it. The Islamic Emirate need to find a way for creating unity in Afghanistan. We are all Muslims, and we believe in God. Anyone who lives in Afghanistan is entitled to live in peace and play their role in the reconstruction of the country.
The religious leaders warn against foreign interference in Afghanistan and stress the urgency to get united.
The only thing that our country needs is peace and unity. We should build trust and get united. We must distinguish between our friends and enemies.
After taking power in August, the Taliban leaders have repeatedly held talks with the Shia community, seeking their support and allegiance. Shia Afghans support an Islamic government, but believe it must be an inclusive one. They want to see people in power who make Afghanistan a safe place for all. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Tensions in several areas in northern West Bank have been high in the recent days, particularly in the village of Burqa, northwest Nablus. On Saturday night, over 250 Palestinians were wounded by the Israeli forces in Burqa, one day after thousands of Israeli settlers attacked the village under the protection of Israeli army. The Palestinian Authority held the Israeli regime fully responsible for what it described as expansionist colonial war. The PA also called on the international community to put pressure on the Israeli regime to stop its aggression and settlers' violence.
The only side which should be held accountable is the Israeli regime. It's responsible for the increasing violence by the Israeli settlers against the Palestinians. It also bears responsibility for a dangerous escalation likely to happen in the occupied lands.
The Palestinian factions have said the settlers' organized terrorism requires the development of a popular action in various ways. This means forming popular guard and protection committees to defend the Palestinians and repel settlers' attempts to storm Palestinians' villages and towns. Anti-settlement organizations have warned that if the settlers' systematic attacks are not stopped, they will turn into real massacres against Palestinians.
I think if it continue like this, it could lead to disasters, maybe massacres. We don't know, but the way that they are attacking the people, the way that they are attacking the houses, trying to enter inside the villages, to enter houses and beat the people there to the extent of killing, shows us that this has to be stopped and has to be confronted strongly by the Palestinians.
Almost 10 days ago, Israeli army imposed military reinforcements after an Israeli settler was killed in the Israeli settlement of Homish near the village of Burqa. Since then, tensions have been high as Israeli forces installed several makeshift checkpoints around the cities of Jenin and Nablus. Thousands of settlers have visited the site over the past days and terrorized Palestinians. Today, Palestinians in many areas are again facing violence and attacks from both armed settlers and Israeli forces. Different political powers say there's an urgent need for stepping up all forms of resistance against Israel. Palestinians call for an international protection, along with dismantling of all Israeli settlements. Mona Qandil, North Occupied, Ramallah.
Israel is stepping up its acts of violence against Palestinians with impunity. Attacks by settlers have grown more audacious recently. In the latest incident, over 250 Palestinian protesters were injured in an Israeli attack on the village of Burqa near Nablus in the occupied West Bank that happened late Sunday. From live rounds and tear gas to rubber bullets and stun grenades, the Israeli forces fired everything they could to ward off the Palestinian protesters. It all started when the Israeli army moved in, deploying soldiers to the Nablus-Jenin road to secure dozens of buses packed with settlers. They also closed off the entrance to the village of Burqa. And that infuriated the Palestinians and triggered protests. In recent days, Burqa has been a flashpoint of clashes. Israeli settlers, with protection from the army, have attempted to raid Palestinian houses there. In a separate accident that happened a few days ago, an Israeli settler ran over a Palestinian woman, killing her near Ramallah in the northern West Bank. It came just hours after settlers attacked a nearby village. That rapidly escalated into a round of violence, with Israeli troops firing rubber bullets and tear gas and injuring at least 125 Palestinians. Pro-Palestinian activist Paul Lorodi believes that Tel Aviv is seeking a policy of isolating Palestinians and forcing them out of their homes.
But the strategy of the Israelis has been to surround large cities like Nablus, as they did in Qarqilia, and to isolate them and to destroy their economy and to force Palestinians to find work elsewhere.
The atrocities go on, but the international community remains silent. That has raised criticisms that the lack of global reaction to the situation in fact gives the green light to the Israeli regime to continue with its unjust policies. Even the UN has lashed out at the world community for remaining tight-lipped in the face of the Israeli crimes. UN Special Rapporteur for Human Rights in the Occupied Palestinian Territories, Michael Link, says the international community must hold Israel accountable for its occupation of Palestine. He says Tel Aviv is refusing to comply with the UN resolutions, including UN Security Council Resolution 2334, which calls for an end to settlement expansion in the occupied territories. Anti-war activist Ken Stone believes a concerted international effort is needed to tackle the situation.
Behind the colonial project in Palestine is the might of the U.S. empire. And the U.S. and its allies, including, unfortunately, Canada, enable this kind of mistreatment of the Palestinians.
Palestinians are witnessing bolder and more violent attacks with each passing day, and they are waiting to see when the international community will finally move to stop the injustice.
It was supposed to ensure seamless trade between the UK and the EU following Brexit, but the Northern Ireland Protocol has become a problem itself. Or has it? Negotiated in 2019, the protocol was aimed at avoiding a hard border between Northern Ireland, still in the EU's single market, and EU member Republic of Ireland. Instead, it's created a regulatory border in the Irish Sea, which acts as a de facto EU-UK frontier. Now, British goods entering Northern Ireland are subject to EU checks and customs regulations. While some have disliked the protocol from day one, others have found it beneficial.
From a business perspective, the Brexit and backstance and the protocol has been a good thing for the people of the north of Ireland. Obviously, we have the best of both worlds. But if you listen to a small minority that is being platformed by the media, both in Britain and the north of Ireland here, you would think that the protocol was damaging business.
That small minority are elements in the loyalist or unionist community in Northern Ireland, people who wish their country to remain part of the UK. They feel they have been cut off from the mainland. Before becoming Prime Minister, Boris Johnson had told pro-UK parties that he didn't want to see Northern Ireland left abandoned by a border in the sea.
Now, I have to tell you, no British Conservative government could or should sign up to any such arrangement.
That assurance fell by the wayside. A sense of betrayal prevailed. Protests ensued. To the UK government, that meant changing the goalposts.
The protocol is not working. It's completely lost consent in one community in Northern Ireland. It's not doing the thing it was set up to do, protect the Belfast Good Friday Agreement. In fact, doing the opposite.
A fact only admitted after the UK left the EU. The European Union rejected any renegotiation of the deal. Some experts believe the government must have known about the problems ahead from day one of Brexit, calling into question the UK's credibility as an international trading partner.
The UK has absolutely no credibility internationally. We've seen that the two biggest partners in the world, the EU and the American government, have made statements on how they feel about the UK renegotiating international treaties. So even to make any kind of statement with that the UK have any integrity on the international stage now is laughable. The UK have no credibility since the Tory government and Brexit.
Another bone of contention, the UK government's demand to remove the EU's legal oversight role, part of the Northern Ireland Protocol, saying as long as the role of the European Court of Justice continues, the protocol will never survive. But in early December, Prime Minister Johnson's Conservative government reluctantly dropped that demand, at a time when it would appear the majority of people in Northern Ireland want an end to the standoff.
Whether they be Irish Unionists or Irish Nationalists, of course, the Tories have always used unionist for the old divide and conquer strategy here in the North of Ireland. So I think it's just sheer incompetence and of course, the arrogance in it.
Things took a turn for the worse for the UK Prime Minister with the December 18 high-profile resignation of his chief Brexit negotiator, David Frost, who was replaced less than 24 hours later by Foreign Secretary Liz Truss, who openly backed remaining in the EU in 2016. She's now tasked with resolving her country's differences with the EU, what nearly 2 years of negotiations by her predecessor failed to do.
The UK blames the EU for being inflexible and worrying too much about the so-called integrity of their single market. And Brussels blames London for trying to scrap an international treaty that it signed nearly 2 years ago. Experts say there is no obvious way out of the ongoing stalemate, meaning that Brexit is not exactly done yet. Saipur is up, London.
Telecom is a major ICT exhibition in Iran that brings together both private and state actors in information and communication technology to showcase their products and services. After a limited edition last year due to the coronavirus pandemic, the annual event has this year opened its doors to all domestic companies to participate.
Our company produces smart systems that work based on the Internet of Things, and recently we produced a smart assistant for animal farming, which helps the farmer monitor the health of livestock and their latest needs.
In the past 2 years, due to the coronavirus pandemic and the growing trend toward remote learning, we thought it would be a good idea to produce tablets for students to easily follow up on their online education. We are also active in producing apps for a range of uses with a focus on telemedicine.
When it comes to ICT, any advancement affects all other industries. The emergence of the 5G network, for example, was a game changer for surgical operations, allowing telesurgeries to be conducted seamlessly and with higher precision. Like this newly unveiled Iranian-made robotic surgeon called Sina, which uses 5G to allow a remote surgery to be carried out.
Sina surgery system has two main subsystems, a master robotic console at the surgeon's side and a slave robotic system at patient's side, which are connected through a 5G wireless network. So any movement of my hands here are transferred to the slave robotic arms, and it is as if the surgeon is present beside the patient.
For sanctions hit Iran, It's not an easy task to catch up with modern trends in the ICT. However, the government says it has tripled its allocated budget for the ICT this year to encourage local firms to push the industry forward and promote what it refers to as digital economy.
The increase in the allocated budget is a result of the government's special attention to the ICT sector. We are planning to promote electronic government and move away from traditional market toward online market. All this needs a strong infrastructure which the government needs to build.
The government says it is also trying to capitalize on venture capital funds and accelerators to move the ICT sector forward. In recent years, an increasing number of sponsoring firms have turned to this area to support innovative ideas and lead them to the market, the results of which remain to be seen in the years to come.
The ICT sector in Iran is among the hardest hit by U.S. sanctions, but the country says it views any challenge as an opportunity. Officials say this expo gives a small picture of how Iran's ICT has thrived under pressure and tried to keep abreast of the fast-growing trend in the world. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Panic is on the rise among minorities, particularly Muslims in India. While one can be arrested, threatened, or intimidated for even criticizing the majority, threats against the minorities with vicious hate speeches and ferocious social media campaigns hardly face the course of law. In recent weeks, several far-right groups with ties to the ruling party have called for ethnic cleansing of minorities, especially the country's Muslims.
Slowly, they are moving towards their target, that is to make India the fascist country. Unfortunately, the secular parties in India, they are weak, they are not united, they don't pose any challenge to the Hindutva element.
A three-day religious event, which was held in the northern Indian city of Haridwar from 17 to 19 December, faced a tremendous backlash on social and political domains. The event witnessed a dramatic quantity of hate speeches, mobilization threats, and violence against Muslims. Local media reports say some ruling party members also attended the event. Critics say these groups are operating and functioning with a strong political patronage.
Government is trying an agenda which imposed on the Hindutva. They are trying to turn this country into the Hindutva country. And we will never ever allow this government to turn into the Hindutva. We will fight for this democratic right.
They are picking such issues intentionally during elections, and Muslims have always been soft target. Sometimes it's the eating habits of Muslims, sometimes their religious affairs.
While Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi boasts about democracy in India, critics accuse the ruling party of failing to stop violence against the minorities. Since the emergence of ruling BJP in 2014, anti-Muslim sentiments have been on the rise. A police case has been registered to investigate the matter, but there is no arrest yet. Rights activists say there is a less chance of any action by the administration considering the earlier incidents. They say if not addressed in accordance with the rule of the law, it could tear apart social harmony in a diverse country like India, which has a remarkable history of communal violence. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com
www.ecit.org/en.
In the limelight.
The climate crisis has put the end of oil onto the agenda, but achieving that is a colossal task given the world economy's deep dependence on petroleum. The article you're about to hear has been written by staff at Agence France-Presse. The piece is titled Climate Crisis Puts Oil in the Crosshairs, but Dependence Persists. Climate crisis has put the end of oil onto the agenda, but achieving that is a colossal task given the world economy's deep dependence on petroleum. In 2021, several developments showed clearly that the petroleum industry doesn't have a future, said Romain Walalalan at the activist group Oil Change International. The International Energy Agency, the IEA, warned in May that an immediate halt to new investment in fossil projects is needed if the world is to reach net zero carbon emissions by 2050, and to stand any chance of limiting global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius. The call was a revolution for an agency created in the wake of the first 1970 oil shock to protect the energy security of rich oil-consuming nations. Another major moment in 2021 was the emergence at the COP26 climate summit in Glasgow, Scotland, of a coalition of nations that pledged to phase out oil and gas production, although no major oil and gas producing nation joined that group. It is no longer taboo to talk about the end of extraction of hydrocarbons during international climate summits, said Oil Change International's Romain Ualalan. And fossil fuels, which still represent 80% of energy consumed, were explicitly blamed for driving climate change, which was not the case when the Paris Climate Accord was reached in 2015. More recently, environmental defenders scored a symbolic victory when oil giant Shell decided to exit the development of the controversial Cambo oil field off Scotland, saying the investment case was not strong enough. "We've known for several years that the end of crude oil is near," said Moez Ajmi, an energy specialist at professional services firm EY. "But is the world ready to live without oil? It is still very dependent, in my view," he said. The International Energy Agency, the IEA, also believes that oil demand is still set to rise. It expects it to reach its pre-pandemic level of just under 100 million barrels per day next year. With crude oil prices having rebounded in the past months, oil producers are rolling in cash and can afford to pursue new projects. any talk of the oil and gas industries being consigned to the past and halting new investments in oil and gas is misguided, OPEC leader Mohamed Barkindo said recently. The head of the French oil firm Total Energies, Patrick Pouyanné, said he's convinced that transition will take place because there is a real awareness, but it will take time. Patrick Pouyanné believes the issue is being approached from the wrong end. Instead of focusing on reducing oil, attention should be shifted towards consumption. Demand for fossil fuels will decline because consumers have access to new products like electric vehicles, said Pouyanné. In the first half of the year, electric vehicles accounted for 7% of global auto sales, according to the Bloomberg News Agency. While that is still a small percentage, it is growing fast. Oil Change International's Romain Iolalan said that arguments put forward by oil companies and oil-producing nations are cynical and focus on the short term. They're trying to justify an unsustainable trajectory at any cost, he said. We're still far from a decarbonized economy, of course, but it is the energy system investments that are made today that will lead us there, said Romain Iolalan. Whatever the horizon for the end of petroleum, industry players are still only willy-nilly preparing for it as pressure upon them mounts. U.S. oil majors ExxonMobil and Chevron were long holdouts but finally announced this year investments into the energy transition. 2022 has the potential to be truly transformational year, said Tom Ellicott, Senior Vice President for the Corporate Analysis at Energy Research and consultancy firm Wood Mackenzie. Tom Ellicott added, it's clear that sitting on the decarbonization sidelines isn't an option, given the increasing pressure on the oil industry. Experts believe that 2022 will see more investment in wind and solar power and renewable energies, as well as technology to capture carbon emissions from fossil fuel power plants and factories.
Start.
Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the peak.
On Youth Station. Youth Station.
I am a Muslim.
I am a Muslim.
Islamite.
Islamite.
Allah my Lord.
Allah my Lord.
His word Quran.
His word Quran.
Muhammad Prophet.
Muhammad Prophet.
Praise be upon.
Praise be upon.
I am Muslim for all of time.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. You're listening to Youth Station broadcasting from IRIB English Radio Station. With you today is Brother Habib at your service and Sayyid
Ja'far. Assalamu alaikum. How are you?
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for coming, brother. So, of course, Sayyid, if you could please introduce yourself, where you're from.
Okay, I am originally Pakistani, but I was brought up in the U.S., in Houston.
So you're from Texas?
Yes.
Oh, from the southern part of the United States of America. No, we're from the sunny part of California. Anyway, so, Sayyid Ja'far, we're going to be talking about your intentions in life. Not my intentions in life.
My intentions.
Your intentions in life.
Okay.
All right. So, I need a background.
Okay.
You give it to me, like, slowly how you came to Qom to study in Hausa.
Okay, so how did I come to Qom? It's a good story, honestly, I guess, in my opinion. Again, it's my story. But so I was...
It's about you.
Exactly.
We have to give you an award. Self-pride.
So I was brought up in a Pakistani household, but my parents are from Karachi, so the south of Pakistan.
Oh, Mushia's over there, yeah.
Yeah, so near the ocean, right?
Yeah.
At the edge of Pakistan.
Beach boy, yeah.
Ironically, before I was born, my parents moved to America. And where did they pick? They picked a city that looked, had the same weather as Karachi. It had the same, to an extent, the same location as Karachi. And it had a lot of people who, I guess, they were accustomed to that culture. You had a lot of Pakistanis move there.
So the community was a Pakistani community.
It was. It was a Pakistani community. Now, ironically, Houston is in the south of America. It's near the coastline. Its weather is pretty much close to Karachi, where it's hot and humid. And it's not fairly that cold over there. Again, if it goes anywhere near 32 degrees Fahrenheit, or for my Celsius listeners here, 0 degrees Celsius, you would consider it really cold over there. We're not accustomed to the cold. But I was brought up there. I was born there. I was brought up there. Again, my parents had put me into an Islamic school at the beginning. Now, again, the basis of that was to at least keep my base of Islam intact, right?
Good parents.
Not to get shattered by the Western thoughts, culture,
lifestyle,
all of it, right? So it doesn't shatter that image of Islam that's
just between your words.
Obviously, their goal in the beginning was to safeguard that base, right? Make it strong enough where you can actually go out and the culture won't affect you as much as someone who doesn't have a base, right? But after a while, that school was only for elementary years, so I was only there to sixth grade. But then after that,
In high school, you were in public school, right?
Exactly. After that, so seventh and onwards, I was in public school, right? That's where I really saw what the quote-unquote American culture and lifestyle was.
America, yeah.
Right? So from that standpoint, obviously it was a shock for me because I was accustomed to a certain way of, say, not even just living, but even studying, getting to know people, interacting with people, right? From an Islamic background, immediately into a Western background. But because of that base, right, I didn't falter as much as someone who went straight into that American culture, right? Regarding the aspect of me coming to Qom and why I wanted to come to Qom, honestly, over there was a gap between the speakers, the scholars that used to come from Qom, and the youth over there. You had scholars who had studied for 30, 40 years, but they kept no connection with the West. So they had less connection with the youth compared to someone who was there in America growing up with them or understanding the issues that they were facing. And honestly, like I saw most of the, again, I was part of the youth, so I saw that most of our issues weren't being tackled. So I had made the decision to come and study myself and also, in a sense, keep a contact over there to understand what was going on and tailor those things that I was learning and seeing how I could help the youth that were there at that time and the youth that are going to come in the future and help them tackle those needs, those basic needs that they have in the West.
So that's your intention in life. Now, ladies and gentlemen, we have to take a short break. We will be back to continue this discussion. Welcome back, dear brothers and sisters. Welcome back to Arab English Radio Station. You guys are listening to Youth Station. We are talking, me and Sayyid Jaafar, we're talking about the concept of your intentions in life. How did you gain that love, that passion? So it was like, I know it has the parental background. They might have planted the seed that has grown into you, mashallah. But at the end of the day, still, there has to be a personal drive for your intention.
I feel like my personal drive was also just to honestly gain knowledge on my own here, to understand, like, really get the knowledge at its roots, right? Not to just hear it from someone else. Because at least back in the day in the U.S., the main issue was you went to one mosque and they were saying something. You went to another mosque and they were saying something completely different, right? Just even if you don't fall into the whole Western culture trap, you're going to get lost between the different ideologies within the mosques.
Very nice.
Right? There's a lot of back and forth between the mosques themselves. I guess, in a sense, yeah, they are diverse. But if someone wasn't in line with the practices at one mosque, they would go and make their own mosque. They would run with their own practices. Now, a youth growing up in the West,
of course, for all the Christians out there, you guys do the same thing with your community churches.
So a youth growing up in that environment, seeing all the differences here, not seeing a connection, at least the way it should be.
So you're intrigued. You're curious about knowledge.
Exactly. I was curious to see...
What's the reality? What's the truth?
Why is everyone, you know, just splitting apart and doing their own thing? Why aren't we all coming together and doing something?
Of course, brother was saying that he wanted to know the reality. He wanted to know the fact. And I see that a lot in houses. But most of the students, especially those who come from the West, usually the reason that they have come to study, they have left their families, they have left their hometowns, they are homesick. Of course, they're not homesick with Sayyidina Masum alayhi salam. Yeah, with the shrine of Lady Masum alayhi salam, there's no such thing as homesick. But what I mean is that they left their homes, they have come to live in a different country, a new culture, and to study, to just go 4 hours of classes and go back to their homes and study more. The main reason why they do that is to know reality. They want to know what is the truth so they can follow the truth. And I really ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to bless you and to aid you more on your path. And now, of course, every human being in their intentions in life, your intention is to go back, what I understand, is to go back and to, you know, try to fill up that gap.
Yes.
How are you doing with your plan right now? Because, you know, we all have plans. I have a plan to be king of the world, but it's not going very good. Anyway.
Obviously, I can't say that, you know, everything has gone through the way that I had thought it out when I first got here. But again, keeping that goal in mind is really what's pushing me through all the hurdles that are coming up over here, right? Be it the sanctions, be it the school system here to an extent. What I mean is, obviously, the way they teach you in the West and the way the teachings are done in the East are different.
The methodology of teaching.
Yeah, the methods are different. Obviously, understanding and growing up with a Western method, it's harder to grasp the Eastern method of teaching.
The teachers on the board giving you prizes and, you know, showing you stuff and images and stuff like that. Here you come down, you open the book, you look at the teacher while he's talking, you have to understand every single word that comes out of his mind. And that really makes smart people. It really does. Even though it might be a hard way, but if you put your time on it, it makes you a smarter person.
It does. The struggle that you go through here, at the end of the day, it does yield a stronger...
When do you plan on going back and continuing? Because, you know, I believe that every human being should, you know, make their goal into parts, right? Step by step. There's the big step that you have to take that you say that I have completed this stage, right? I have to go on to another stage. When is that stage that you want to go back into, you know, the U.S. and continue your missionary goals?
In a sense, I had originally come with the idea of, you know, at least studying, say, 10 to 15 years. Right? Sure. Really have a sound base.
You want to be soaked in the knowledge.
Exactly. Where, in a sense, where any question, any concern that comes my way, like, I have an answer for it, right? I don't want to leave them, you know, empty-handed. But then now also seeing how rapidly things are changing in the West and how it's becoming even more difficult for Muslims over there, I might have to cut back on that. I might, instead of doing 10 years, it might be 6 or 7 years.
Just to add on to something, 6 and 7 years is not enough.
That's true.
The goal that you put 10 to 15 years, I was going to say, is acceptable. I wanted to say that at least, like, you have to study more. And there's no such thing as stopping from studying.
That's true.
Always seeking knowledge throughout your entire life. But I think that in Hausa, in your level, in my level, I think the main base for us is to understand the mythology of, for example, they ask me a question. I'm not Google, for God's sakes. I'm Habib. I forget. I eat cheese. I forget. So when you ask me a question, I'm not going to lie to you. I'm going to tell you I don't know. But give me for like a couple of seconds, I'll go back. There's this nice story that I want to share with you, brother. It's a nice story for you. It's a nice story for the listeners out there who, you know, how to deal with missionaries. We're not infallibles. We do mistakes. We forget sometimes. There's this great Ayatollah, Sayyid Hussein al-Shahrudi. He gives out Kharij, Dars-e Kharij, which is pretty much the top level of studies here. Right? It's like a professor in your language. Anyway, he was asked a question, a simple question, a fiqh question that maybe me and you, even 6 years back, if I was asked the question, I would be able to answer it. He told him that, what's the difference between me and you? You told me you don't know the answer, that you have to go back home and check the book or check the issue. He told them that the difference between me and you is that when I go home, when I go to my 1,000 books that I have at my house, it is true, because I also have 1,000 books in my house. He has more. I'm pretty sure he has more. It's much bigger than mine, because I have a lot of examples. Anyway, when I go back home, I know where to go to the book, I know what page it is available in, and I remember it. As for you, when you go to that same library, you stand over there at the library, you don't know what book to open.
Well, at first you're just intimidated by looking at the library.
Then you want to open it. Okay, you opened it. Where do you find it? Okay, let's say you found it. Can you understand it or not?
That's true.
So there's also a similar story. The structure of knowledge, knowing the structure of knowledge, knowing where this issue is available at, knowing the books where this issue was stated or mentioned, really helps us out. Another story that's similar, Sayyid Sa'id al-Hakim, the Marja, the great Ayatollah that passed away recently in Najaf. When people would come and visit him, they would ask him a question. He told them, give me Minhaj al-Salihin, the book where he has the issue, the fiqh issue, the verdict. He told him, give me. It's his book. He read it with his own hands. He forgot it. It's not a problem. We're not infallible. You know? So I think that the main thing is not to be able to answer right away. It's to deal with the community in a proper way and to know the knowledge structures. For example, they asked me a question about aqa'id. Where do I go? Theology, ideology, creeds, beliefs.
Okay, so my point of saying that, look, of me having the answer right then, and it wasn't just right then and there, but being able to have access to that answer, right? Yeah. Because most scholars who haven't read as much, who haven't studied as deeply as they should have,
they don't know the structure.
And they come back, they're lost.
Yeah, exactly.
It goes back to that same story that you said. They know what it might be. They can beat around the bush all they want, but the core answer, they don't know where to look. Exactly. They don't know where to cite it.
Very nice.
Right? At the end of the day, I'm saying to just all those students as well, whatever field you're learning, right? In a sense, start teaching the basic concepts as well to further understand that through teaching, you really understand how much you don't know.
Exactly.
Right?
Nice.
You don't just read a book and be like, oh, look, I understood it. When you explain that book to someone else, that's where you really find out how much you don't know.
Now, I want to ask you a question. You know, alhamdulillah, you have an intention in life. I have an intention I'm not going to tell you on the radio. You want to know the intention? Invite me to your place. We'll have dinner. I'll tell you my intention if you're intrigued. Anyway, say it. Now, some people think that there is no necessity to have an intention in life. You don't have to have a goal in life, you know? It's enough that you're alive. Let's be alive. Let's taste. Let's test. Let's experience. Let's just be happy. Do you think that's proper? That's rational? Because I personally believe that that's not rational at all. Because when you say that I want to be happy, that's your intention in life. That makes it a goal. It's impossible to not have an intention. Anyway, what's your view on it?
Honestly, I agree with you in that aspect. If you don't have an end goal, whether it doesn't have to be a grand goal, it just has to be a goal personalized towards you, right? You're going to be stagnant in your life. You're not going to be moving forward, right? At the end of the day, life is there for you to move forward and understand more things, right? Meet more people. Indulge in other cultures and other societies, right? It isn't just, look, I'm just going to do my thing. You know, what's your goal? I don't have a goal. You know, I'm just, you know,
wanna be
just
okay.
Testing the waters out, right? How long are you going to test them out for? You're going to lose that, the aspect of living, right? You're going to, in a way, you're going to be killing yourself without being dead.
Thank you very much, Sayyid, for your beautiful words and your story. And thank you guys for joining us. Until another Youth Station, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.